Hello, hello, hello. Here's Marlanka again with an episode from another episode from Sri Aurobindo, Essays on the Gita. This one taken from Chapter 5, Kurukshetra. Consider once more the situation from which the Gita arises, but now in its largest bearings as a type of human life and even of all world existence. For although Arjuna is himself concerned only with his own situation, his inner struggle and the law of action he must follow, yet as we have seen, the particular question he raises, in the manner in which he raises it, does really bring up the whole question of human life and action. What the world is, and why it is, and how possibly, it being what it is, life here is, and why it is, and how possibly in the world can it be reconciled with life in the spirit. In all this deep and difficult matter, the teacher insists on resolving as the very foundation of his command to an action which must proceed from a new poise of being, and by the light of a liberating knowledge. But what then is it that makes the difficulty for the man who has to take the world as it is, and act in it, and yet would live within the spiritual life? What is this aspect of existence which appalls his awakened mind and brings about what the title of the first chapter of the Gita calls significantly the yoga of the dejection of Arjuna? The dejection and discouragement felt by the human being when he is forced to face the spectacle of the universe as it really is, with the veil of the ethical illusion, the illusion of self-righteousness, torn from his eyes before a higher reconciliation within himself is effected. It's that aspect which is figured outwardly in the carnage and massacre of Kurukshetra, and spiritually by the vision of the Lord of all things as time arising to devour and destroy the creatures whom it has made. This is the vision of the Lord of all existence, as the universal creator, but also the universal destroyer, of whom the ancient scripture can say in a ruthless image, the sages and the heroes are his food, and death is the spice of his banquet. It's one and the same truth seen first indirectly and obscurely in the facts of life, and then directly and clearly in the soul's vision of that which manifests itself in life. The outward aspect is that of world existence and human existence proceeding by struggle and slaughter. The inward aspect is that of the universal being, fulfilling himself in a vast creation and a vast destruction. Life, a battle, and a field of death. This is Kurukshetra, God the Terrible. This is the vision that Arjuna sees on that field of massacre. War, says Heraclitus, is the father of all things. War is the king of all, and the saying, like most of the apothegms of the Greek thinker, suggests a profound truth. From a clash of material or other forces, everything in this world, if not the world itself, seems to be born by a struggle of forces, tendencies, principles, beings. It seems to proceed, ever creating new, ever destroying the old, marching one knows not very well whither, to a final self-destruction, say some, and in an unending series of vain cycles, say others. Progressive cycles is the most optimistic conclusion, leading through whatever trouble and apparent confusion towards a higher and higher approximation to some divine apocalypse. However that may be, this is certain, that there is not only no construction here without destruction, no harmony except by a poise of contending forces won out of many actual and potential discords, but also no continued existence of life except by a constant self-feeding and devouring of other life. Our very bodily life is a constant dying and being reborn. The body itself, a beleaguered city attacked by assailing, protected by defending forces whose business is to devour each other. And this is only a type of all our existence. The command seems to have gone out from the beginning. Thou shalt not conquer except by battle with thy fellows and thy surroundings. Thou shalt not even live except by battle and struggle and by absorbing them into thyself in other life. The first law of this world that I've made is creation and preservation by destruction. Ancient thought accepted this starting point so far as it could by scrutiny of the universe. The old Upanishads saw it very clearly and phrased it with an uncompromising thoroughness which will have nothing to do with any honeyed glosses or optimistic scuttlings of the truth. Hunger, that is death, they said, is the creator and master of this world. And they figured vital existence in the image of the horse of the sacrifice. Matter they described by a name which means ordinarily food, and they said, we call it food because it's devoured and devours creatures. The eater eating is eaten. This is the formula of the material world, as the Darwinians rediscovered when they laid it down that the struggle for life is the law of evolutionary existence. Modern science has only rephrased the old truths that had already been expressed in much more forcible, wide, and accurate formulas by the apothegm of Heraclitus and the figures employed by the Upanishads. Nietzsche's insistence upon war as an aspect of life and the ideal man as a warrior, the camel man he may be to begin with, and the child man hereafter, but the lion man he must become in the middle if he's to attain his perfection. These now much decried theories of Nietzsche have, however much we may differ from many of the moral and practical conclusions he drew from them, their undeniable justification, and recall us to a truth we like to hide out of sight. It is good that we should be reminded of it first, because to see it has for every strong soul a tonic effect, which saves us from the flabbiness and relaxation encouraged by a too mellifluous philosophic, religious, or ethical sentimentalism. That which loves to look upon nature as love and life and beauty and good, but turns away from her grim mask of death, adoring God as Shiva, but refusing to adore him as Rudra. Secondly, because unless we have the honesty and courage to look existence straight in the face, we shall never arrive at any effective solution of its discords and oppositions. We must see first what life and the world are. Afterwards, we can all the better set about finding the right way to transform them into what they should be. If this repellent aspect of existence holds in itself some secret of the final harmony, we shall, by ignoring and belittling it, miss that secret, and all our efforts at a solution will fail by fault of our self-indulgent ignoring of the true elements of the problem. If, on the other hand, it's an enemy to be beaten down, trampled on, excised, eliminated, still we gain nothing by underrating its power and hold upon life, or refusing to see how firmly it's rooted in the effective past and the actually operative principles of existence. War and destruction are not only a universal principle of our life here in its purely material aspects, but also of our mental and moral existence. It's self-evident that in the actual life of man, intellectual, social, political, moral, we can make no real step forward without a struggle, a battle between what exists and lives and what seeks to exist and live, and between all that stands behind either. It's impossible, at least as men and things are, to advance, grow, fulfill, and still observe really and utterly that principle of harmlessness which is yet placed before us as the highest and best law of conduct. We will use only soul force and never destroy by war or any even defensive employment of physical violence? Good, though until source soul force is effective, the assert force in men and nations tramples the good down, breaks, slaughters, burns, pollutes, as we see it doing today. But then, at its ease and unhindered, and you have perhaps caused as much destruction of life by your abstinence as others by resort to violence. Still, you have to set up an ideal which may someday, and at any rate ought to, lead to better things. But even soul force, when it's truly effective, destroys. Only those who have used it with eyes open know how much more terrible and destructive it is than the sword and the cannon. And only those who do not limit their view to the act and its immediate results can see how tremendous are its after effects, how much is eventually destroyed, and with that much all the life that depended on it and fed upon it. Evil cannot perish without the destruction of much that lives by the evil. And it's no less destructive even if we personally are saved the pain of a sensational act of violence. Pausing at this point, page 42, to be continued in the next episode. Thank you for listening.
This is Oroville Radio.